Welcome to another Sabbath.
It's great to be here. We'll continue the sermon series, Attitudes. So the title of this sermon is Attitudes, Part 2. In Part 1 of this sermon series, we looked at the attitude of it's not fair, which is an attitude of self-pity, poor me. We looked at how God had allowed Satan to attack Job. Satan had tried to provoke Job into blaming God. Satan tried to get Job to complain, basically, and blame God for what had happened to his possessions and the death of his 10 children. Job's attitude was revealed in Job 1, verse 21. If you want to just quickly turn there, we'll just review that. Job 1 and verse 21. In Job 1 and verse 21. And he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gives, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." So Job at this point has the right attitude. He had the understanding and the right thinking that everything came from God. He acknowledged that his wealth didn't just happen, but that God was in charge and that God had given him the wealth and his children. He accepted that God was in charge and in control of everything. Job had to handle the grief of losing his 10 children and most of his servants. He did not say, "Well, it's not fair," and turn and blame God. Verse 22. In all this, in the death and destruction, Job did not sin nor charge God with wrong. He did not blame God as Satan said that he would. We also then looked at how David planned the death of Uriah the Hittite so that he could marry Bathsheba. We then saw how God sent Nathan the prophet to relay a story to David for the purpose of exposing David's sin, his wrong motive, his attitude. We then saw David's attitude of repentance and acceptance towards the death of his firstborn son. David did not blame God for the death of his son. And we'll pick that up in 2 Samuel 12. 2 Samuel 12 and verse 22. 2 Samuel 12 and verse 22. And he said, "While the child was alive, I fasted and wept." So David was pleading with God at this point of time and had fasted and was crying out to God about his child being sick. "For I said, who can tell whether the Lord will be gracious, show mercy to me, that the child may live?" Verse 23. "But now he is dead." So he said, "I accept God's decision about what has happened. Why should I fast?" So there's no point now, because God has made a decision, and now David is saying, "I accept that decision. Can I bring him back again? I shall go to him, but he shall not return to me." So this attitude is very important. This is a very important spiritual attitude that we need to have, which is accepting God's decision about things in our life and in the church. And I ask the question, will we accept God's decision in the way he leads us today? And it's worth thinking and contemplating that. Then we started to look at how God allowed Satan to attack Job's health. Satan's intent is still the same, and that is to attack Job so that Job would curse God and blame God. So the purpose of the continuation of this sermon, today we're going to continue to look at the number of different attitudes revealed in God's Word. We are doing this for the purpose of adjusting our thinking, our attitudes, to bring them into check. And we went into the topic of death. Death of a family member and how we view it from our own personal situation. And we take it personally because the child or the husband or the wife belongs to us in our own thinking. Whereas God says clearly everything, all children, anyone that is associated with us or to us is and does belong to God. And therefore we need to watch our attitude with it, because we don't want to go into depression about a death of somebody, a child or a family member, because what is that deep depression really? It goes back to the very beginning. If we're not careful, it can turn into self-pity. I lost something. We don't grieve about other people's children or children in Africa or elsewhere. So we need to be careful and to bring our thinking into check, just like David had said. Then we covered a statement. What we are or become is based on attitudes we have chosen or choose. So the way one person grieves is not the same as another person grieves. People in the world grieve a particular way. Now, the only way that they can truly grieve is from the natural carnal mind. They don't have God's spirit. So they don't understand a resurrection. They don't understand a second life. Therefore, they will look at death totally differently. Totally differently than a member of the body of Christ with God's spirit can see and understand what is happening. And that God is in charge of everything. So if a member of the body of Christ, for example, the church member dies, we shouldn't go into depression about it. We should handle it differently because the way that God has laid it out is God is in charge. God has a plan for all mankind. He will resurrect them, and to be resurrected in the 100 years is an enormous blessing because all the trash of this world will not exist. And it's going to be much easier for that person than living in this current cesspool. It really is. So that is a different way of thinking. Now, we have that way of thinking. God has changed our thinking to His, the way He sees it. We agree with God that that is the best option and that God in His mercy will give them that opportunity and it's going to be easier for them. The attitudes we choose make up what we are. As we choose God's attitudes, God's thinking, we then develop a new way of thinking about everything. We look at, for example, death differently. We look at the way a killer, a murderer, should be handled. The world doesn't. They handle it differently. They think they're showing mercy, but they're not. But we know the best thing and greatest mercy would be that if they were put to sleep, they were killed, put to death, and they were resurrected in 100 years where they got a great opportunity to develop God's mind. So you can see how we think differently. And we think differently because of God's spirit, because that's what God is doing. He is changing our thinking over our lifetime. Then we started to look at Job 38 and how God was questioning Job. And we'll pick it up in Job 38, verse 1. Job 38, verse 1. Now remember that Job at this point had made a lot of statements, and I'm not going to go through all that story, and his friends had turned up and were saying things to Job, but he was not accepting any of those statements. He was hanging on to his own integrity. In other words, he saw himself as right. Job 38, verse 1. Then the Lord answered or responded Job out of the whirlwind, the tempest or the storm, and said, "Who is this that darkens counsel or advice by words or speech without knowledge, without discernment and understanding?" In other words, why do you confuse the issue, Job? Why do you talk without knowing what you're talking about? So here is somebody that thinks they have knowledge and they've lifted themselves up and they're right in their own eyes. But here is God now going to correct Job in his thinking, adjust his thinking, by revealing to Job God's great power. And that Job has lifted himself up when really he knows nothing. He actually knows nothing at all. He might think he does, but anything he may know has been given to him from God anyway. All knowledge comes from God. Verse 3, "Now prepare yourself like a man." In other words, get ready, stand up out of the ash heap. "I, God, will question you. I'll inquire of you. And you shall answer me." You'll give back your knowledge about what you think you know. And we continued through there with those scriptures and we left off in verse 15. And we're going to pick it up now in verse 16. In verse 16. "Have you, Job, entered in the deep springs of the sea?" Job, have you gone under the sea? Have you been right down deep? Or have you walked in the search of the depths? In other words, have you gotten to the bottom of things, explored the bottom caves of the ocean? You know, the deepest point's about 27,000 feet. So God's saying, well, he knows what's down there. He created it. Job, do you know what's down there? Have you walked through those caves, the labyrinth of caves? Have you been down there? And of course, you can understand Job here now going, I thought I knew some things. and I thought I was speaking wisdom, but in actual fact, I don't know much at all. Verse 17, God speaks figuratively here in many examples. Have the gates of death been revealed or uncovered to you? So do you know how to control death? Do you know how to control life and death? Or have you seen the doors of the shadow of death, caused death, and then given life again? Have you resurrected anyone? Do you know the first thing about death? That's what really the question is. Do you know anything about life and death, Job? Do you have one clue with regarding the death of people and the dark mysteries about death? Can you cause death? Can you resurrect somebody? Do you give life to people? Verse 18. Have you comprehended the breadth or the wide expanse of the earth? Tell me if you know all this. Do you have any idea how large the earth is? Now remember, we do know the size of the earth now, but Job at that time didn't. He didn't know about the size of the earth. So God's now asking a question to challenge his thinking. Speak up if you know the beginning of this answer. And of course, Job wouldn't have known this. It wasn't revealed to him at that time. Verse 19. Where is the way or the journey to the dwelling of light, the sun? And darkness, where is its place? In other words, where does it go at sundown? Do you know the light, where the light comes from and where the darkness lives? We have a lot more knowledge today. But so this question really is just challenging Job's thinking. Verse 20. That you may more take it to its journey, that you may know the paths of its home. In other words, do you know how to change the angles of the sun? So when it comes up, can you change the angles of it as it goes across? Can you rotate it? Can you move it? In other words, control the seasons? Can you take it by the hand and lead it home so it doesn't get lost? And you can understand Job now. He's really starting to understand. He doesn't know anything. He actually doesn't understand all this. God created, he understands every aspect of it. Verse 21. Do you know it because you were born then? Do you know what you're talking about because you were created at the same time? Were you around when the sun was born and created? Were you there? So that's why you know so much? Or because the number of your days is great? You're so old that you've been around so long. And of course, we don't know Job's age, but we can take that on our own selves. You know, what do we know and why do we know it? Well, we only know it because of our age, because we've been exposed to knowledge. So we can also look at it, how do we know spiritual knowledge? Now, the greatest thing that we have to be careful of is that we don't think that we have spiritual knowledge because of ourselves. It was only God in his great mercy that called us out of this world and gave us spiritual sight. So all the glory goes to God. We take no credit to ourselves for spiritual knowledge. Verse 22. Have you entered the treasury or the storehouse of the snow? Or have you seen the treasury of hail? Now there's another question. Well, where does the hail come from? Have you travelled where the snow is made? Have you seen the stockpile of hail? Have you seen all that? Job would have to answer, well, in his mind he'd be going, no, I don't know anything about that. Verse 23, which I have reserved for the time of trouble, for the day of battle and war. Now we know that God, on the last great day, i.e. the last day of the seventh trump when it's blown, we know that God is going to use hail to destroy. So God is saying, well, do you know that I've reserved all this, that I can create it and I can use it? Another way of putting it, can you produce and control snow and hail that God uses to punish? And the answer would be, no, I have no control over that. Verse 24. By what way is the light diffused or divided or apportioned or distributed? Or the east wind scattered over the earth? Can you find the way where the lightning is launched? So do you know where it, and now when the lightning, when two clouds, we know today that when two cold air and hot air clash, clouds, that lightning is produced. But how do we know its direction? How do you control the direction of the lightning? Where it's going to stop? What it's going to strike? Of course we can't. God's in control of his creation. God controls the weather. Verse 25. Who has divided a channel or a water trench for the overflowing water? In other words, when a flood comes. Or a path or a distance of the thunderbolt. Who does that? How can you control where it rains and when it doesn't rain and where the lightning bolt's going to strike when it strikes a tree or doesn't strike a tree? Can you chart the route of a thunderstorm What direction? Now, we know in today's society we have people called storm chasers, and they've got all the scientific equipment in their cars, and they get caught in the middle of a storm because they don't know which way the tornado is going to go. They've got a rough idea, and most of the time they're so excited and pumped because they have no idea, really. They have no control over where that thunderstorm is going to go, where it's going to start exactly, when it's going to finish, and what damage it's going to do. They don't know its path. Verse 26. To cause it to rain on the land where there is none. So can you make rain on the desert? Can you do that? A wilderness in which there is no man. Can you cause it to rain there? To satisfy the desolate waste, or rain in a desert area, and cause to spring forth the growth of a tender grass. So can you cause the drenching rains on a desert so that the plants will all come up for a short period of time? Has the rain a father? Or who has begotten the drops of dew or the night mist? Who produces the rain? From whose womb comes the ice and the frost of heaven? Who gives it birth? So do you think all this has a father? Are you the father of this? Who creates it all? The waters harden like a stone, in other words, become ice, and the surface of the deep is frozen. You don't imagine for a minute the marvelous things that happen in weather just happen, do you, Job? Do you think it just happens, or do you think it's made and controlled? Then God goes on and asks about the planets. Verse 31. Can you bind the cluster of Palaites, I think it is, a constellation of seven stars? So can you get them, can you put them up there and hold them there? Did you create those? Or loose the band of Orion, a constellation? Can you bring Maseroth into its season? Or can you guide the Great Bear with its cubs? And it's talking about the planets. Can you control those? Can you bring them on the seasons? Because at certain times you can see them and certain times you can't. Do you know the ordinance of heavens? Can you set their domain over the earth? Job, can you control the planets? Can you control them and set them up and create patterns? Can you do that? Can you have the planets affect the earth like the moon affects the earth? Can you control any of that? Can you lift your voice to the clouds that an abundance of water may cover you? Can you give direction to the clouds and command it to rain? Now we're going to go through this because God goes to a lot of length. If he goes through all of these things for a purpose, and it's written for a purpose, to bring a mind into thinking to realize that God is almighty and that we are nothing. Compared to God, we know nothing. And to come to understand that we only know what we know because God's revealed it to us, to mankind. And that's why we know it. Other than that, we wouldn't know anything. It was interesting, there was a TV program the other day and my granddaughter was watching it, and it was about a rain dance. And the cartoon characters danced around to try to cause it to rain. And my granddaughter, who's 5 going on 6, turned around and says, "That doesn't work, does it, Papa?" Which, and that's a 6-year-old knows that a rain dance is a worthless exercise of man's thinking. And out of the mouth of babes, you know, how stupid is it to go out there and dance around and yell out to try to make it rain? It's just absolute stupidity. Man has no control over the weather. God does. Mankind tries to seed clouds to make it rain and do all these different things. But God is in control of seasons. He created them. He knows. And God says he uses the weather as a form of punishment. We know in the millennium that he talks about that he won't give rain in certain places to people who will not come up and keep the Feast of Tabernacles. Because God is in control of the weather. And even my granddaughter at 6 years of old knows that rain dances is just stupid. It doesn't work. Verse 35. Can you send out lightning that may go and you say, "Here we are"? In other words, can you control a lightning strike? Can you actually make it strike where it strikes? Can you control it so that it strikes in a particular place? Verse 36. Who has put wisdom or thinking in the mind? So the spirit of man, who's put that in? Why does a man think, or a woman think, a human think, versus an animal? Who worked that out? Who puts it in all the time? And when a baby's born with the spirit of man, who puts it in? Or who has given understanding or discernment of heart? Can you make a person think, Job? Can you place the spirit of man into somebody? Can you create human intellect? Can you choose which human is given more or less wisdom? Can you control any of that? Verse 37. Who can number or count the clouds, the fine dust, by wisdom, by skill? Can you count dust particles? Or can you pour out the bottles of heaven, in other words, cause rain, when the dust hardens in clumps? Can you do that so that certain dust, when it rains, forms into a cluster when it dries up? Can you control that? And the clouds cling together? So now God draws attention to the creation of animals and animals' natures, because Job's now being challenged in his thinking that he thought he knew a fair bit and he was holding to his integrity that he did. So God now has moved on from those planets and the earth and the rain, and now he moves into the animal kingdom, because all the animal kingdom is different. And anyone who has animals knows that each animal has its own character, own individual character. So sheep, all sheep are not the same. They all have different attributes and characters within that sheep family. But within the animal kingdom, they're all different. And it's quite interesting what God goes on and says about animals and how he created them and how he controls their nature because he put it in them. Verse 39. Can you hunt or provide the prey for the lion, or satisfy the appetite of young lions? Can you provide for them? When they crouch in their dens or lurk in their lairs to lay in wait, who provides food for the raven when its young ones cry out to God and wander about for lack of food? So who does all that? Job 39 verse 1. Do you not know the time when the wild mountain goats bear young? So now here we're having when the goats, do you know what time it is? So what day is it that the goat's going to give birth? Can you mark the time when the deer gives birth? In other words, can you establish this, Joe? Can you actually establish it exactly? Can you number the months or the lunar cycle that they are fulfilled? Or do you know the time when they bear young? So when is it going to happen? Do you know the exact time? They, the goats, bow down, they bring forth their young, they deliver their offspring. Their young ones are healthy, they grow strong with grain, they depart and do not return to them. So in other words, there's a law in place. God has established a law and it will follow a pattern. Now, where we live at the moment, there are certain birds that actually come at certain seasons and they fly as far back to Russia. Would you believe? From Russia. But that's their cycle. And they know the way. God's saying, well, he created all that. Isn't that incredible? God is almighty. And yet we have scientists and people spending millions of dollars trying to work out how a homing pigeon can find home. God created it. God knows exactly because he created it. And you know, one bird is born and it knows the way. Isn't that incredible? It knows the way. It's a law that God has built into each individual animal. The point is that God created the animals with their own characteristic and their own traits. Verse 5. Who set the wild donkey free? Or the self-willed stubborn animal. That's what it's really talking about. Who put this self-willed stubborn animal? Who did it? Who made the donkey stubborn? Why is it stubborn compared to a horse? Who loosened the bonds of the wild ass, is another word. Whose home I have made in the wilderness, and the barren land its dwelling. He scorns, it's talking about the ass, he scorns or laughs at the noise of the city. He does not heed, he's stubborn. He doesn't heed the shouts of the driver. So you can say to the ass, go! And it just stands there. You don't care. So who did that? Who built that into the donkey? The range of the mountains is his pasture, and he searches after every green thing. So he's driven to eat. He will just wander and eat and eat and eat. Verse 9. Will the wild ox be willing or consent and serve you? Will the ass come and just automatically serve you? Will he bed in your manger? So will the wild buffalo descend, come down from the mountains and volunteer to spend the night in your barn? No, it won't. You're going to have to go out there and capture it, and you're going to have to train it. You're going to have to try and control it. And you know how hard that is? It's very difficult. because they are built in, from God has built in them, a stubborn, like a rebellious nature. They'll do what they want to do when they do it. Now, I don't know whether you've ever ridden an ass or a mule, and you can kick it, you can do lots of things, and it just stands there. It ain't going anywhere unless it wants to go somewhere. Now, there's horses like that as well, and I'm sure some of you have ridden horses that have got their own mind. You know, you can do whatever you want, but they're just not moving. Verse 10. Can you bind the wild oxen in the furrow or the ridge with ropes behind you, or will he plough the valleys behind you? In other words, will the ass just automatically do this? Will it just come out there and hitch itself up and do it? No, it won't. Verse 11. Will you trust him because of his strength, and it's because his strength is great, or will you leave your labour to him? So what it's really saying is, well, are you just going to trust the ass that it's going to get up in the morning and the buffalo, and they're going to hitch up and they're going to go out and plough the field in the right direction, then they're going to come home to the barn at night? No, you're going to have to get out there and do something about it. You can't trust him because God made him of the nature that he ain't going to be doing anything without encouragement. Will you trust him to bring home your grain and gather it into the threshing floor? You can't depend on this animal, is what God is saying. The point is that God is making to Job, he, God, can be trusted to provide for us. But you can't trust on anyone else, but you can rely on God that he will be our provider. He said, he promised he'll provide for us. Verse 13, the wings of the ostrich wave proudly, but are her wings and pinions like a kindly stork's? The ostrich flaps around, it is beautiful, but guess what? It's useless. That's what God's saying, it's useless. It can't fly. So who created that? Who created it so the ostrich can't fly? God did. For she leaves her eggs on the ground and warms them in the dust. So she lays her eggs on hard ground, then she leaves them in the dirt exposed to the weather. She forgets that a foot may crush them or a wild beast may break them. So this ostrich has no care about her egg. Why is that? Why doesn't the ostrich care about that egg? Because God made her that way. Verse 16. She treats her young harshly as though they were not hers. Her labour is in vain, without concern. So the ostrich has this mindset, it's not really concerned about the young. Because God deprived her of wisdom and did not endow her with understanding. So that's why, because God did it. But Job has no control over that. Verse 18. When she lifts up herself on high, she scorns the horse and its rider. The ostrich doesn't care. It has no fear of these things. It just runs around. And you can have a horse and its rider running around, but the ostrich doesn't care. It just runs around. I don't know whether you've ever seen an ostrich in the wild. It just runs around. Verse 19. Have you given the horse the strength? Have you clothed the neck with thunder? So in other words, what it's saying is, God's saying, well, have you given this horse strength? And you see a beautiful stallion, and it is very strong. Have you given it its beautiful mane? Can you frighten him with a locust? Why is this horse not scared? Her majestic snorting strikes terror. So when a horse is in a battle, it rises up and it's fearless. He paws in the valley and rejoices in his strength. He gallops into the clash of arms. He paws the ground. He eagerly waits to go into the fray, into battle. And even men are scared. Humans are scared to go into battle, but a horse isn't. Verse 22. He laughs at danger, fearless, doesn't shy away from the sword. 23. The quivers rattle against him, the glittering spear and javelin. So the banging and the clattering of that doesn't bother him, doesn't faze him. Verse 24. He devours the distance with fierceness and rage, nor does he come to a halt because of the trumpet that has sounded. The horse really quivers with excitement, and it is desiring to get into the battle. It will gallop straight into the battle. Verse 25. At the blast of the trumpet he says, aha! He smells the battle from afar, the thunder of captains and shouting. So at the sound of a trumpet he neighs mightily, smelling the excitement of the battle a long way off, charging like a roaring thunder and the cry of war, he races forward. So why is the horse not scared of battle when humans are? You know, the history of mankind is that through the ages, generally, for mankind to go into battle, he normally got himself intoxicated or hyped himself up into a high level of excitement, a challenging, often smoking drugs, because they knew it was, You can't be fearful. Because if you let a moment of doubt, when you're charging into battle, one moment of doubt come into your mind that there's a possibility you're going to die, there's a strong possibility you're going to turn around and head out. It's generally the camaraderie of men, and it's the excitement of the battle. And the horse, of course, is born that way. God created him that way, that he will charge ahead. Even if the rider's a bit hesitant, the horse is going to go straight ahead. We'll drop to Job 40, verse 1. Job 40, verse 1. Moreover, the Lord answered Job and said, "Shall the one who contends or debate with the Almighty correct him?" So, because this is what it's really about. Here is Job. Is Job lifting himself up so much that he's going to tell God that he's wrong? "He who rebukes or corrects God, let him answer." Really, Job is now starting to see himself in the light of the way God is. God is almighty. Job isn't anything. He was created. Verse 3. Then Job answered the Lord and said, "Behold, I am vile, or of little account." So Job's starting to see himself now. "What shall I answer you?" So what can I say? "I lay my hands over my mouth." Job started to see himself compared to God. And that's what we need to do, brethren. We need to see ourselves in the way God sees us. Now, how does God see us? God sees us as begotten sons. Potential Elohim. That's the way God sees us. God doesn't see us as minute little cockroaches running around. God created us for a purpose. God is enjoying the creation in the sense that he sees an outcome. He created man for the purpose of entering Elohim. So God doesn't see us as minute nothings. God sees us as potential family. Elohim. It's the way God views us. But if we are to lift ourselves up, God will have to humble us to bring us down, to understand that we are nothing of and by ourselves, and it's only by God's great mercy and love that we are anything, and that we can be anything. Verse 5. "Once I have spoken, but I will not answer. Yes, twice, but I will proceed no further." So he's going to say, "I'm not going to say anything else. I am just going to listen." We'll drop down to Job 42 and verse 1. Then God continues to work with Job, asking Job questions. And Job comes to this conclusion in Job 42 verse 1. Because the only way you can change an attitude is to have new knowledge. Otherwise, we will retain the attitude or opinion we have because we think we're right. So the only way that you can change an attitude or the spirit we have, which is an attitude, is that we have to be told something different. Otherwise, we'll hold on to our own integrity, just like Job was. Job 42, verse 1. Then Job answered the Lord and said, "I know that you can do anything," or that you can do everything. In other words, acknowledging God is almighty. God is almighty. "And that no purpose, no thoughts can be withheld from you." So Job, another way of saying it, "I'm convinced you can do anything and everything. Nothing and no one can set their plans apart from you." What really is happening here is Job's starting to see that God is almighty and that he is nothing. If you'd like to hold your place there and turn to Ecclesiastes 3. Ecclesiastes 3 verse 14. Ecclesiastes 3 and verse 14. This is what Solomon had learnt and has made a statement. Ecclesiastes 3 verse 14. "I know that whatever God does," and that is decides to fashion, "it shall be forever," everlasting. "Nothing can be put to it," in other words, nothing can be added to it by anybody. God's plan is set and is perfect. We can't add to or take from God's plan. "And nothing or anything taken from it, diminished. And God does it," God decides to fashion it. "Why? That men should fear before him, stand in awe, fear with reverence. What God plans will happen exactly as he planned it." You can't change it. We can't change it. Nobody can change God's plan. And God has a plan that is precise and exact. And we're living an aspect of God's plan. And we have just been through a period that was precisely planned for God's church, and we have lived through that. What a blessing. For the last 6,000 years, there's many that have never had that opportunity to know God or know God's plan. They've just lived their life as physical human beings, as what Solomon said, as Mr. Harrell went through, that what profit is it when you labour all your life and you get to 90 and you die and you leave your inheritance to your grandchildren or your children, and guess what? They all fight over it. They divide it all up. Most of them just waste it. Some don't. But that cycle's been going on for 6,000 years. And they haven't known God and God's great plan. They don't know the purpose of life. But being called into the church, we know God, we know God's plan, and we know God's purpose for us at this particular time, which is to enter Elohim. Verse 15. That which is, or now and is past, has already been. That which is today was planned by God. It's been a long time back, was planned a long time ago. So it's exactly as God planned it. It was planned beforehand. And what is to be in the future has already been. Why has it already been? Because it's been planned out. It's exact. The exact timing of Satan's removal, the exact timing of Jesus Christ's return has been planned, and it will be exactly as God planned it. There's no deviation from God's plan. It's been planned and determined by God. Verse 15, continuing. And God requires an account of what is to follow. So it is planned and it will happen exactly. God's planned it. It will happen. Nothing can change it. No one has the power to change what God has planned. God has planned 144,000. There's not going to be 144,006 because some man's decided that what he wants to do. No, there's going to be 144,000, just as God planned. Verse 16. Moreover, I saw under the sun, on the earth, in the place of judgment, justice, or the court system, wickedness was there. So what he's looked at and says, well, I've considered, and all I've seen is wickedness. I've considered this. And in the place of righteousness, or justice, iniquity, wrong, was there. So this is man's systems. I took another good look at what's going on around me, and every place where there should be justice and judgment, there's corruption. If you've ever had any dealings with man's system, you'd understand this, true? You have to go through it to understand it. If you've ever been through the justice system, I remember a long time back, we had opportunity that I had to file particular tax returns, and the accountant at that point in time didn't file those tax returns. I was under the understanding that those tax returns would be filed. And I'd closed all the business down and everything like that. Well, 5 years later, of course, I get a summons to appear in court for failing to lodge tax returns for 5 years, even though they are zero. So in the process of time and much distress, we were in the church, new in the church, we had to face the legal system of mankind and the taxation system. Well, it ended up in court, it ended up the accountant was disbarred, and of course they fined him in disbarring him. And we were awarded some costs and we didn't have to pay court costs. Well, then of course the legal system kicks in, and guess what? You know, people don't pay. So the only way back then was to get any justice was to go back to the bailiff, and he would go out and try to issue a summons to get payment. Well, that went on for a long period of time because there is no justice in the system. There's not. It's not designed to be just, to be fair and right in the way God designed things. Justice is slow. God's way of justice is swift. You're brought to account, swift outcome. So man's system is corrupt. And here, Solomon's saying what he could see. Verse 17. And I said in my heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked. And there is a time there for every purpose, every desire, and for every work. Well, God will judge the righteous and the wicked. Both are going to be judged. There is a right time for everything. Every deed will be brought into account. There's no getting around anything in life. People live life as if they can get away with it. God knows everything. God understands human thinking. He created it. And everything will be brought into account. We cannot hide our attitudes from God. Is another way to put it. So whatever attitude we have towards others or about situations, it can't be hidden. If we were to judge ourselves, our attitudes, we would not be judged by God. Now, in the world, they cannot judge themselves. They cannot discern their own thinking. But we've been called into the God's church for that very purpose, which is to discern our thinking. And we bring it into check. Is it right? Is it in tune with God's? Is this the right attitude to have? Now, I know about situations with regards to driving and lots of other examples in life that we can form wrong attitudes very quickly towards other people. And we have to bring those attitudes in check. It's not that we don't have those bad attitudes, because we do. We have them. It's part of our nature. And when it gets the better of us, we develop wrong attitudes towards people we so-called love. We do. That's just who we are. And it can happen quickly. And before you know it, we realize that was the wrong attitude. I'm displaying a wrong attitude. I'm not loving. I'm failing to love. Therefore, I need to correct that attitude or that spirit that's coming from me. Going back to Job 42. So the process of life is about bringing our thoughts into judgment. Job 42, verse 3. Job 42, verse 3. You, God, asked, who is this who hides or conceals counsel or advice without knowledge? In other words, in ignorance. Therefore, I have uttered or declared what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me which I did not know. So Job is now realizing that he knows nothing compared to the Almighty God. Verse 4, listen please and let me speak. You, God, said, I will question you and you shall answer me. Let me speak and let me give answers. You can give answers. Verse 5, I have heard you by the hearing of the ear. Now, when we hear that, it's reports from others. Now, before we were called, we had heard of God through the hearing of ears. True? We'd heard it. We'd heard of God. Did we know God? We didn't have a clue. We had no idea. None. Zero. Zilch. Any understanding we had is polluted from false religion. And it takes a lifetime to come to the understanding that in reality we thought we might have known of God. We might have known of him, but we did not know God and his righteousness. Job is saying, I've heard of you by the hearing of the ears, reports from others. Now, we hear of reports from others through false religion. But now my eye sees you. How can we see God? Only by the power of God's Spirit. God can only reveal himself to us through the power of his Spirit. In other words, we've been called, we are in a state of repentance, we've been baptized and we have received God's Spirit through the laying of hands. Now we can see God, and therefore we start to understand God's righteous attributes. We understand God's plan to various degrees, and God continues to reveal himself, his love and mercy to us on a progressive basis. Truth is revealed progressively and we grow in that. So Job is saying, now my eye sees you. Job's eyes were open on a spiritual level. He stated he himself was nothing, but God was almighty. He sees God to a degree, a limited degree. Now that God has called us from this world's religious confusion, we can begin to see spiritually, spiritual matters. We can see God. We see God's purpose. We know God's purpose in our life, which is to create Elohim. His plan for salvation. The only way we can be saved is through the church. That's why the church was created by God. Jesus Christ established the church so that we could be fed, so that God can create Elohim. So we see his plan of salvation, his righteous character, because the only way is by the power of God's Spirit. And we've been given that opportunity. Verse 6, therefore I abhor or despise or reject or loathe myself. And now Job's starting to realize he loathes himself for raising himself up with his opinions and his thoughts. He really does. He's despicable in his own eyes before God. And repent. He's really sorry for the things that he's thought and said in dust and ashes. And another way of saying it, I'm sorry for lifting myself up in my pride. Please forgive me. Because I thought I knew something. I knew nothing compared to God. Brethren, because we have been called, we have come to see that we exist because of God's great mercy. We are in the church, the body of Christ, because of God's great mercy and love for us. We of and by ourselves are nothing. So that's what Job came to see. If we have views, opinions, attitudes that are not in unity with God's thinking, we are using our base selfish nature. Without God's Spirit, we are nothing but selfish. It's a difficult concept to fully grasp, but that's the way we set out to please ourselves. Romans 12 and verse 1. And Mr. Harrell covered this in a sermon not long ago, but we're just going to go back over it because it outlines much. Romans 12 and verse 1. Romans 12 and verse 1. I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, because it is by God's mercy, that you present or yield your bodies a living sacrifice. Now, when we started this sermon series before this one, we were looking at sacrificing ourselves. Now, that is about a giving attitude. So we're willing to deny ourselves what we want to benefit somebody else. So it's like a giving attitude. There's a scripture that says it is more blessed to give than to receive. But as you go longer in God's church and God's Spirit convicts you, we begin to understand that it's easier to give than it is to receive. And if you analyze that and say, well, why is it that it's easier to give? Because if you've got something to give, it's quite easy. There's not a lot of pain involved because you're giving. Because why? Because if it's not given from God's Spirit, it's sin. Because we're giving for the wrong motive. We're giving because we're getting something back. People's view of us or opinions or self-gratification. Why is it hard to receive when somebody gives you something? Because we, by nature, are independent, self-reliant by nature. So if somebody gives us something, we tend to refuse it, reject it. Say, oh, no, 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 I don't want it. It's harder to receive. Why? Pride. Because of this self-reliance. You see, we're independent. Pride will say, oh, no, I don't want to receive it. It's harder. And it's a lesson that we learn over time in the church, that there is a time to give and there's a time to receive, all to the glory of God. Thank God for that. Whatever God provides, we've got to watch our attitude towards giving and receiving. So here it's saying that you present or yield your bodies as a living sacrifice. In other words, a giving attitude. We're to put our selfish desires down. Holy, separate, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. That's what we've been called into the church to do. To deny the self. An ongoing process. The moment we stop examining ourselves, checking our attitudes, and denying the self, we have spiritual problems. Because we've got to work on it. We've got to work on it over time. And there's good days, and there's bad days. That's just normal. That's part of being in the church. There's good and bad days. Just like David had. Good days and bad days. Because attitudes get in the way. And we don't sacrifice ourselves. We don't deny ourselves. But then we see it. We repent. And we strive to deny ourselves for the benefit of others. Verse 2. And do not be conformed or pattern or fashion to this world. So we're not to be patterned after the way of the world. What's the way of the world? The way of get. Acquiring for self. You don't deny yourself, surely. In the world, you don't. And if you do deny yourself in the world, you're getting something. There was a program the other day about someone was saying in the world system that they were entering a fast. And then you find out they're drinking all day. Sorry? Because, see, that's human thinking about fasting. Fasting is denying yourself food, but not drink. Where God says fasting is deny yourself food and drink. Just a different way of thinking. But to them, they're fasting. So we're not to be conformed or fashion ourselves after the world, the way of get. We're to deny ourselves. But be transformed. That word transformed is metamorphe, which is change. To change into another form. So we've got this carnal mind, we're to change our way of thinking by the power of God's Spirit into another form, another way of thinking, the way we think towards others. How? By the renewing or complete change for the better of our mind or of your mind. So we're to change the way we think. And we can't do it without God's Spirit. It's not possible. Not possible. That you may prove, and that word prove is to test by living it. what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. So don't conform to this way of the world. Don't get involved in its system, its way of get, the way of doing things, but transform the way we think. So we will put ourselves down to benefit others, including our enemy. Now that's the hardest. You know, when it says, when he was reviled, he reviled not. Now, Christ did it with the mind of God, but when we're reviled, it is a difficult, difficult thing because we tend to want to defend ourselves and to revile back because that's our natural carnal mind. When somebody puts us down or says something ill towards us, our tendency is to desire to get even. That's what we want to do. But Christ said when he was reviled, he didn't revile back. He didn't accuse them or go against them. And that, of course, is a way of thinking. Depends how you think about it. If we have the thinking that they don't know any better, you bring it into perspective, and their opinion of us is what? Who cares? We should care about what God thinks of us. Therefore, when someone reviles against us or attacks us, we shouldn't try to defend ourselves. What's the point? It shouldn't bother us if we have the right mindset. We shouldn't justify ourselves because we don't need to. God's justified us. You can see the difference in the way we think, the change that has to take place. So we're to prove God's way by living it. What is that good and acceptable, perfect will of God? Don't conform, but transform our way of thinking. Our focus needs to be towards the needs of others. And that's a simple way of putting it. It's the way of give. We should look how we can benefit others in all situations, work, church, everywhere. That's our focus, is how do we benefit others? And when we're fronted with various situations, we should look towards others what is best for them, as long as it is godly. Buying a smoker a packet of cigarettes is not the best thing for them. It's to deny them it. That's showing love, is to deny them the packet of cigarettes. Another way of thinking. When Christ was on the earth, he revealed the spiritual intent of God's holy righteous law. He explained that our thinking needed to change, and this is the way it was. We are to choose and develop attitudes that are motivated by the Spirit, to live the spirit of the law. And we'll look at Matthew 5. Matthew 5 and verse 17. Matthew 5 verse 17. Do not think or suppose as a custom that I came or have come to destroy, and that word destroy is dissolve, get rid of, or throw down the law, the commandments of God, or the prophets, and a prophet is one moved by the Spirit of God. I did not come to destroy or dissolve or throw it away, but to fulfill, and that word is to render perfect, complete, as to fill to the top, so that nothing shall be wanting to its full measure, make greater, fill to the brim. So what it's really saying is that Jesus Christ came to live the perfect intent of the law. So Jesus Christ fulfilled it in the sense he lived it. Well, prior to this, without God's Spirit, nobody could keep God's law in its spiritual intent. They could keep aspects of the law on a physical level. Not killing, not stealing, they're physical. But the intent, the motivation, the heart, Jesus Christ lived it to its fullest. So he came to magnify the law to show its real intent of why the law was made. The law of God was given for the church. God's church, but it requires God's Spirit to live it. And that's what we understand. And therefore we have the power to live the spiritual intent of the law. And that's why we've got to continually discipline ourselves. Because there are times when attitudes well up that are not the right intent of the law. It's against God's law. And Christ saying, well, he came to fill it up, to reveal it, to show how it should be lived, to have the right attitude. When reviled, he reviled not. That's an attitude. Christ lived the law to its perfect spiritual intent. Verse 18. For assuredly I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, one jot or one tittle will by no means pass from the law till it is fulfilled, has come to pass. God's law is more than just words. It is about an intent. It's about a spirit. It's about an attitude. God's law is to be alive and working within us because it's a way of life. It's a way of thinking. It's the way we think towards others and towards God. Verse 19. Whoever therefore then breaks or unloosens to destroy, dissolve, or do away with, or to change. So it's about a tense that is past. So anybody that changes God's law because they don't understand it, because it's about a spiritual intent. Yet one of the least of these commandments and teaches men so in word or action or by the way they live shall be called or so named as least by or in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does and teaches them by the way they live these laws shall be called so named great by the kingdom of heaven, by God. So we're not to trivialize God's law. Now, we know that mankind doesn't understand God's law. They've done away with the fourth commandment, God's Sabbath. It's done away as far as they're concerned. They can't live it. We live the Sabbath by the way we conduct ourselves. We don't work and we do not take on work on a physical level, but also in the mind. We discipline ourselves so that we don't spend all day on the Sabbath, Friday night sunset to Saturday sunset, thinking about what we're going to do tomorrow for work. We don't earn a living on the Sabbath through our mind, because there are a lot of people that keep a physical Sabbath, rest, do not work physically, but they break the spiritual intent of the Sabbath by thinking physically. So I know a lot of people in times past that are connected to certain Jewish communities that do keep a Sabbath on a physical level. But the reality is that Christ came to reveal they actually break the Sabbath because of their thinking. Because it's in the inner man, it's the spirit, it's the attitude, it's the way we think. Just having time off for a 24-hour period is not keeping the Sabbath holy, separate, because it's about the intent, the law in the mind, the way we think. So we're not to trivialize God's law in any way. The smallest thing of God's law has not changed. And when that talks about a jot or a tittle, it's the smallest little comma has not been taken away from God's law. God's law shows us the way of obedience. It's because life is either about obedience or disobedience. It's black and white. We're either obeying God in the spiritual intent or we're not. Pretty straightforward. One way or the other. There's no grey area or middle ground area. Verse 20. For I, Christ, say to you, for unless your righteousness, which is your intent, exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. Now, the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees was a physical appearance, which was self-righteousness, selfish, an outward show that reflected that they were spiritual. Have you ever seen that? Outward shows. You might ask and say, well, why does a Catholic priest wear a collar back the front where there's a bit of white showing? Demonstrates something that shows you an outward sign. Well, the Pharisees did the same. The Pharisees had an outward sign, so they would pray in the synagogue where everyone could see them. And God says, well, that intent, that attitude is wrong. When you pray, you're to go into your private place and you're to pray. People shouldn't know you're praying. That's what God's saying. So you can see about attitude. One attitude is, look at me, I'm righteous. You just don't know how righteous I really am. Another attitude is, I'm going to go and do what God says, and I'm going to go in private and I'm going to pray. Nobody knows you're praying except you and God. So they have this outward show. You will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. So if you've got this attitude, if we have this attitude of self-righteousness, of outward show, of trying to get praises from men, we cannot enter the kingdom of heaven. It's impossible. There are only two ways of life to be lived. To have God's Spirit living and dwelling in us, which makes us righteous, that's one. Or to not have God's Spirit and therefore be self-righteous, carnal, and selfish. Black and white. Obedience, disobedience. Often you see TV programs where people turn around and say, and have said to me, oh, that person is very spiritual. That person is spiritual. You hear it. They dress spiritually or they're spiritually minded. They can be doing anything. They might meditate for 2 or 3 hours and someone will turn around and say, oh, that person is just so spiritual. Because they don't understand what spiritual is. So you might have heard this statement that this person's spiritual. Often, I know there was this monk that was rolling to Mecca or something, you know, like they said he's so spiritual. He fed the monkeys all day in the temple. He was a Buddhist. He's just so spiritual. He's dedicated his life to that temple and the monkeys. He's not spiritual, but the world thinks he's spiritual. Different way of thinking. The truth is, a human can only be spiritual if God's spirit dwells in them. Simple as that. God is spirit. God gives spiritual knowledge, spiritual wisdom, his mind. Wisdom is God's mind, God's thinking. So we can only be spiritual when we think like God, and we can only think like God if God's spirit dwells in us. Spiritual is then measured by the way we live, the way we think towards others, motivated by God's spirit. So that's when we're spiritual. It's about having God's spirit dwelling in us. If we want to do spiritual works, it's about God living and dwelling in us to the benefit of others. That's what's spiritual. Spiritual is reflected by and in our godly attitudes we live towards others. So we live love towards others. James 4 and verse 1. James 4 and verse 1. James is addressing the church. And it covers the different attitudes that we can have. These attitudes exist in the world, but they also can exist in God's church in the spiritual intent of a matter. James 4 verse 1. Where do wars or battles and fights, and that word fights is persons at variance, dispute, strife or contention. So where do these battles, where does this contention come from among you? This is talking about the church. So why are there brethren in the church in disagreement with each other? Where is that coming from? Do they not come from or out of your desires for pleasure, your lusts, that war in your members, in your thinking? So this attitude of contention is one of being argumentative. So the moment we begin to argue about a point, often irrelevant, but we think we know and the other person's wrong, and we start to debate or argue, where's that spirit coming from? Where's that attitude coming from is the question. Where is it? It's coming from the desire to be right. It's coming because we want to justify ourselves in our own eyes. We want people to believe us. So that's where it's coming from. It's coming from a desire within ourselves that we want to be right, we want to be heard. So when you have a discussion with somebody and you find one person raises their voice, what is their motive of raising their voice? We can see it in the world. Why is somebody now speaking louder than they did before? It's because of pride. They're trying to dominate. They're trying to have their opinion over yours. So what normally happens in the world is the other person starts to speak loudly as well because they want you to hear their opinion. And then the other person then raises their voice, and before you know it, two people are shouting. So when two people in a marriage are shouting at each other, what's it saying? It's a battle of the minds. It's about dominance. My opinion's right. My opinion's right. My opinion's right. My opinion's right. Because that's what it is. They're battling and warring. There's contention. What's the spirit of that? Pride. It's pride that's driving it. I'm right, and you don't know it. And until you stay quieter, I'll raise up to convince you that I'm right. So arguing, if we get into an argument or debate and raise our voice, we need to stop and check our attitudes. What's motivating me raising my voice? Verse 2. You lust, and that is desire for what is forbidden, and do not have. You murder and covet and cannot attain. So what do you mean, you murder? What do you mean, you murder? We don't kill each other in the church. Well, if we transfer through communication or thought any words that condemn or fail to love somebody, we murder them. That's what God says, because it's a spiritual intent. It's not a physical act of going out and killing somebody. It's because of the thought. Now, if you look at Cain and Abel, when Cain killed Abel, where did that start? Where did murder start? In the mind, motivated by envy. Didn't like what was happening. He raised himself up in his thinking. It just didn't all of a sudden happen. It was a process of thinking. So this is where it starts with us. We have to be very careful that we don't start a process in our minds of murder, which is speaking evil of others, failing to love, or condemning words of somebody. And covet, envy, and cannot obtain. You fight and war, yet you do not have because you ask amiss, because we leave God out of the picture. We ask amiss because we should be turning to God to give us the right attitude, the right spirit, His mind. So now we've taken it on ourselves, we're going to judge what's right and wrong. We're going to condemn another man's servant. We raise ourselves up. Verse 3. You ask and do not receive, because you ask amiss, or you ask wrongly, that you may spend it on your pleasures. So we ask for the wrong reasons. Selfish motives is what's happening here. Verse 4. Adulterers and adulteresses. What do you mean? We've been just been called a murderer. James is calling members of the body murderers. Now he's saying we're adulterers and adulteresses. In other words, we're committing adultery. Now, of course, that's when you look at it, people just think on a physical level. This is talking about a spiritual level. To be an adulterer or an adulteress means we've been unfaithful. When I'm unfaithful to God, I'm an adulterer. When I'm unfaithful to somebody else, I'm actually the spirit of adultery. I'm betraying a trust. So to be unfaithful is to engage in a wrong relationship. God has been left out of our thoughts. Do you not know that friendship with the world or a relationship with the world is enmity with God or is hostile to God? So if we engage in relationships away from God and we engage in things of the world, relationship with the world, we have to be very careful how far we go to make sure we're not committing adultery on a spiritual level, because it's in the mind. We abandon God, leave God out, we become unfaithful to God. We no longer believe God or trust in God or have God involved in our life, and we become self-reliant and start to have relationships with things we shouldn't. We commit adultery because our relationship is with God the Father and Jesus Christ. Whoever therefore wants to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy, or opposing an enemy of God. That's what it says. So if we're going to take on the world, we will end up being an enemy of God. You can't have both ways. You're either going to be faithful to God and in a relationship with God and obey God in obedience, submit our will to God, sacrifice the self, because that's what we know by the power of God's Spirit, or we're not. Black and white. We know from Romans 8 that the carnal mind is selfishly motivated. So there's only two ways of life. Obedience to God that leads to righteousness, or disobedience to God, which is sin and leads to death. There's no grey area, it's black and white. Verse 5. Or do you think that the Scripture says in vain, the Spirit, the human spirit, which dwells in you, the carnal way of thinking, the selfish thinking, yearns jealously? That word there is really desires an advantage. Our natural mind desires an advantage over others. So verse 5 is really saying is, we by nature desire praise and recognition from others. That's just what we are. That's who we are. We desire people to praise us, to build us up, to give us credibility. I was thinking before about why the peer pressures of the youth in particular, why there's peer pressure. Because they want to be accepted. They want to be accepted in the group. They don't want to be odd or left out of that group. So therefore, if somebody's got a particular style or a particular type of boot, you'll find that the group moves because of this pressure. Why? Because this carnal mind yearns jealously. It desires praise and recognition from others. It wants to be accepted. The natural carnal mind wants to be accepted by others. We by nature are concerned with what others think of us. That's just the way we are. Now, once you're called and come into God's church, over a process of time, you come out of that. And we begin to see that we do not care about what others think. And the amount of what we care is reduced. Now, it depends on the relationship. If you're in a bigger family that is hostile to you because of now God calling you, you tend to care for a little bit. You try to keep the peace. But in the end, you desire that you want to have a relationship with God. You want to put God first. And therefore, what they think of you doesn't matter. But that's something we all have to go through to different degrees. We do not care what other people think about us. Now, people might think strange things of us, but we accept that. We think differently. We acknowledge we think differently. We know they can't understand. They can't understand God's law. They can't understand the spirit of the law. They can't understand that we're disciplining our attitudes. They can't understand that we think we're selfish. They can't understand that. You know, we're a crazy people to them. Well, that's a badge of honor. That's a badge of honor that we should wear on behalf of God, because God is creating Elohim in us, and we accept what God is doing. We desire what God is doing. God, change my thinking. Change my attitude. I want to be like you. I don't want anything to do with the carnal natural mind. Nothing. The sooner you get rid of it, the better. So by nature, we are concerned with what others think of us. We crave, lust for, long for, pursue praise and acceptance from others. Now that's our natural state. That is our natural state. So the moment we feel we're trying to draw back to the world and to be accepted by them, that should be a warning bell. You know, we don't want to be accepted by the world. We don't want to be accepted by the world because we don't want what they've got. We've fled that. We're away from it. We don't want it. We don't want to be conformed to the world. And really, it's talking about the pride of life. Look at me. So people form into small groups, into various gangs, whatever, because people conform to images because they want acceptance. What are initiations? When people go to university and all that, they say you've got to be initiated. Well, what's that really? It's about acceptance. This is the natural mind craving an acceptance. Otherwise, you're going to be on the outer, and this group won't accept you. And you want to be accepted. You want to be like them. So that's what people do. They go through these initiations, even against their will, really, because underneath they still want to be accepted, even though they've got to go through this particular initiation. Football teams, it's everywhere you go. It's about being accepted. Pride is a false image that we have of ourselves. That's what pride really is. Pride is a false image we have of ourselves. We desire to lift ourselves up in the eyes or thinking of others. And that's life. That's the natural carnal mind. I remember many meetings that I used to go to in various organisations, and you could always tell who was so-called the most important person in the room. Now, the most important person in the room generally in business was the one who had the most money. And they had the most money, and you generally knew they had the most money, and it was communicated by other groups that, oh, did you know that's such and such? Because what it's really doing is about, well, the natural mind says, I need to get to know that person. I need to introduce myself to that person. Why? Why do you need to introduce yourself to that person? Why do you need to get to know that person? Because there might be something in it for me. Deep down. Deep, deep down in the natural carnal mind. It's trying to get something from somebody else. But in the world, can't be seen. Yet for us in the church, it should be obvious. You know, people gravitate to people. It's somebody with wealth. People gravitate to them. I've always thought if you ever inherited a lot of money, I wouldn't tell anybody. Because all the friends that you thought you didn't have, you've now got them. They're all your friends. Why is that? Why is it when somebody sometimes wins lotto and they have all this money and all of a sudden they get thousands of letters and that? What's that all about? Well, because someone's trying to get something from you. That's what it's really all about. People are gravitated to where they can acquire something. One of the attitudes of the Pharisees was, I'm not like them. I'm not like them. What's that about? I'm not like them. Well, that's vanity, that's pride, that's self-righteousness. Remember, they would say, I do this, I do that, I fast twice a week, I give offerings, I do that, I pray, and I'm not like them. In other words, all that other lot down there, what they're doing, because they don't do any of that. I'm closer to God, I know God, and they don't, because can't you see? I do all these things. But God's not saying that's what's required. We're not to have the attitude of the Pharisees, self-righteousness. We are to rely on God. Verse 6. But he gives more grace, favour, mercy and help. Therefore, he says, God says, God resists, and that word is really battle or battle against, the proud. So God has to work against the proud because they're lifting themselves up. How can God give something he wants to give to someone who's proud, who already has it all in their mind? He can't. God cannot work with them because they are unteachable. Now, a proud person is someone who cannot be taught. There's been examples with the grandchildren where you might go to explain something to them and you'll say, oh, such and such, such and such, did you know? And they say, I already know that. And the first thing that hits you is, well, because you want to you want to sort them out. But you realise it's just pride. It's just pride. Why is it they have to turn around and say, I already knew that? In other words, you can't teach me anything. There are only eight and they're saying that. That's an attitude that we need to be careful. We must remain teachable. To stay in God's church, we must be teachable. What is the church? Education system. God teaching us, pouring out his spirit, teaching us that we're wrong, that he's right, but we must remain teachable. The moment we become unteachable, God says he resists us because he can't give us more. He wants to give us more, but we're unteachable. We think we know it. But gives grace, mercy and favour to the humble, those of low degree, those that are cast down. To be humble is to have God's spirit and see our true worth, our true spiritual worth. Now, we should see our true spiritual worth. God says we are worth a lot with his spirit because he can create Elohim in us. But if we are unteachable and we're proud, God will have to humble us to help us to see spiritually, to teach us, to bring us down so that we might turn around and say, oh, God, you're almighty and I know nothing. That's what Job was. Job thought he knew some things. In the end, he said, oops, I don't know anything. God, you are almighty. My pride is a stench. My pride is a stench before God, where we lift ourselves up. To be humble is to know what our base nature is. So someone that is humble, if we are humble, we will accept that we're selfish. That is the beginning. If we see our nature, now we can't control it, we try, but we are selfish. Our actions are selfish. We don't sacrifice ourselves anywhere near what we should. So if we accept that, we can go to God in humility. God, I acknowledge that you created me this way, and that's the way I am. I am selfish. My motivations are pride-driven. My intents are not always good. My attitudes are not always right. That is humility. That is humility. Humility is the beginning of repentance. That's why God humbles people, humbles us, so that he can work with us, so that he can give us more. We know and understand that our natural mind is selfish, the way we were created. To be humble is to be repentant and accepting of this truth. That's why the world can't be humble in their state. Now, you've heard this saying, that person is spiritual, but have you also heard, that person is so humble? I sort of get agitated when that happens. You know, because somebody's done something and, you know, they might have saved somebody. And they come up and say, oh, no, I'm not a hero. And they say, oh, that person is so humble. And I was thinking, oh, I twitch. Because they're not humble at all. The natural carnal mind is not humble. It's impossible. Only with God's Spirit can we be humble. Because it's God that gives us humility. It's a gift of God, humility. To be repentant. To acknowledge what we really are. Selfish and pride-filled. We are to be humble, which is to be teachable like a child. Now, children today, I think, are much more advanced and their humility is less and less. But when you deal with a 1 and 2 year old at that level, there's a teachability. There's a respect, an awe to a parent or a grandparent that the parent knows what they're talking about, that they're teachable. And then when they become unteachable, generally early 9, 10, 12, going into teens nowadays, an unteachable person is the most difficult thing to deal with. And if you have God's Spirit, it can actually be very difficult to watch because it's an agony in it. Because when somebody is actually unteachable, you agonize for them because there's a fall coming. We know it. We're in God's church. We know pride comes before a fall. Being unteachable is just simply being proud. There's a fall coming. We by nature want to stop them falling. But there's nothing we can do in God's church to help them to not fall. The best thing often is for them to fall, to realize, like Job, well, I don't know anything. Best I be teachable, I best listen. Verse 7. Therefore submit, and that is yield to be in subjection to God. Therefore submit to God. Let's yield our spirit to God. Let's go to him and yield ourselves to God. Resist, or to set oneself against, to stand, to resist or oppose the devil. So we're to set ourselves against Satan, and he will flee away from you. So we're to battle any temptations or any wrong thoughts. We are to cry out to God to strengthen us. We're to come to see spiritually that a temptation is simply a motivation by Satan that he attacked Job to affect our attitude, to have the wrong attitude, to be selfish, to fulfill the desire of the flesh. Now, we all know when we're being tempted. Well, we should. And what you find over time is that the temptation comes early in the church. You'll start to think a certain way and you don't pick it up straight away. You don't see the temptation. You don't see the forming of a bad attitude or a wrong way of thinking towards somebody. And at the end of it, you then see it. But it could be too late. You might have already formed an opinion. The longer you're in God's church, you're more sensitive to what an attack is, or sensitive to an attitude that you're forming. And you know straight away that you shouldn't be thinking this way. It's wrong. Jump on it straight away. Turn to God. Cry out, God, this thought process is wrong. I don't want to have it. And start to think of something positive. And it is possible through the power of God's Spirit to overcome it. Verse 8. Draw near, that word is join to God, through prayer and fasting, through repentance. And he will draw near to you. He will join to you through the power of his Holy Spirit. Cleanse your hands, flee sin, you sinners, and purify your hearts. Purify your thinking, your intent, your attitudes, the way we think towards others, you double-minded. Now, we acknowledge we have a double mind. We have a carnal mind, and we have God's Spirit. So we're both. Verse 9, lament and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to gloom. Take this seriously. One thing about God's church is this is a serious matter. It's a matter of life and death. It's a matter of life and death. Verse 10, humble yourselves in the sight or before God, and he will lift you up. He will strengthen us spiritually. We are to turn to God and ask God to help us to correct our thinking. Correction is a way of life for anyone called into a relationship with God. Now, that is also another point or another attitude we should have. We need to continually accept correction. Correction is a way of life for God's church. Now, if we refuse correction, we will die spiritually. Because we accept our natural carnal mind is wrong, God is right, God is teaching us, correcting our minds, therefore we accept that, therefore we must be teachable, have to be teachable. The day we resist correction from God is the day we are on dangerous spiritual ground. The only way we can grow spiritually is to accept that we need correction. So this is an attitude. So when somebody corrects us, the first thing is we will put up defense barriers. We don't accept it. As soon as you put up the defense barrier, as soon as I put up a defense barrier, it should be a big warning to us that we've got a wrong attitude. We've got a wrong motive here. So the best way is to pull it down and turn straight to God, and God will help us through it. If we do not see the need for correction, we are obviously right in our own eyes. God is right, we are wrong. That's the way we were created, with a mind that is selfish. Conversion is about changing the way we think. Verse 11. Do not speak evil or speak against one another, brethren. So we are not to pull down or to think evil towards others. Verse 11. He who speaks evil or speaks against a brother and judges against or condemns, call to question is another way to put it, to judge. So when we judge, we're speaking against. We've made a decision. We're now condemning. We call into question. His brother, that's one another, speaks evil, is against the law, which God created for our good, and judges and is against the law itself. So we lift ourselves up over God. We call into question God's judgment. We call God into question. We question God. Verse 11. But if you judge, condemn, call into question the law, if you do that, raise ourselves up, you are not a doer of the Lord, but a judge. So we're no longer doing it, being humble, submitting ourselves, saying we're wrong. We're now lifting ourselves up in pride, saying, God, I think your judgments are wrong. Verse 12. There is one lawgiver. There's only one lawgiver, who is God, who created everything. God is the one who passes judgment. He's the only one who can pass judgment, who is able to save and to destroy. So the decision about what happens in a person's life, the judgment that God does, and the implementation of a penalty is up to God. Who are you to judge another? Who are we to lift ourselves up over that person, over God? Who are we to call into question God's judgment? What are we really saying when we speak against another member of the body? What are we really saying? It's an attitude we've formed. Well, brethren, I'll just finish off now. Verse 13 covers another wrong attitude. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a city, spend a year there, buy and sell, and make a profit. So now this is natural mind thinking, life's going to go on, my life's not going to be in any way changed, I'm going to continue to plan all of this, but leave God out of the picture. That's what it's really about. God is no longer first in their life. So this is not about God's will, this is about what I'm going to do, not about what God, so that's why the term is God willing. We intend tomorrow to go to such and such a city, to spend a year there, we're going to buy and sell, and we're going to try to earn a living, this is make a profit, God willing, because we don't know what tomorrow brings. Verse 14, whereas you do not know what will happen tomorrow, for what is your life? It's a good question, what is your life, really? Well, it's in God's hands. It is even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. It's temporary. Our life is temporary. That's the right attitude to have, to understand our life is temporary. We involve God in every aspect of our life. Verse 15. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, or if God willing, we shall live and we shall do this and that. Keep it simple. Depends on God. What's God's plan and purpose in our life? Maybe God has a plan to take our life tomorrow for our benefit and for the benefit of others. Maybe. We don't know. Verse 16. But now you boast, because of pride, in your arrogance, this empty braggart talk. All such boasting is evil. It's sin, because it is self-reliant and motivated by pride. In other words, this is what I'm going to do without involving God in our life. It's an attitude we can form if we're not careful, leaving God out of our decisions, out of our decision-making process. So with that, we will close the sermon of Attitudes Part 2.